baseball. Damn it.
Do better, baseball.
Yes. Well, hello, everyone. This is Matthew Carruth, Lookout Landing, and joining me from the midst of a Utah mine somehow, but coming in through Skype, Jeff Sullivan of another similarly sounding website.
I'm looking for quartz.
Quartz, interesting.
Quartz, I make clocks. I mine and build my own clocks. I do my own quartz mining.
Interesting, okay.
Yeah.
Well, we have a lot to cover in this casting of pods.
And, yeah, because there are a lot of veins of quartz through the granite here.
Okay, you can stop talking about the rocks now.
You put me in a mine, goddammit.
Let's talk about baseball. Baseball.
Why? Baseball sucks. Fucking Mariners. So not only are we coming to you now with the Mariners having lost four games in a row in dispiriting fashion, but we're also coming to you about half an hour after news of Adam Moore's severity of his injury broke.
No, well, that has not put a damper on my mood at all.
It hasn't put a damper on mine either, but it hasn't lifted my mood. Sir. Well, okay. It hasn't significantly lifted my mood. But here's a cool thing. It's bad for Adam Moore. He'll be back in a few months. He's a backup catcher. I don't think neither of us are very high on him anyway for his future. But whatever. This isn't going to cripple his career. But here's a cool thing. Really cool thing. Mariners probably going to call up Josh Bard. Should be official by the time you're listening to this, maybe. And Josh Bard, probably a better hitter than Adam Moore. Probably a better defender than Adam Moore. Leadership, whatever. And he's a switch hitter. Matthew, take it away why that is so much fun with this team.
Well, so the cool thing about being a switch hitter that Jeff and I discovered, at least at catcher, is that gives us the opportunity to roll out the following defensive alignment if Eric Wedge and the Mariners so choose. Eric Bard catching, Justin Smoke first base, Adam Kennedy second, Luis Rodriguez at short, Figgins at third, and the usual outfield of Bradley, Saunders or Langerhans, and Ichiro. Now, that's pretty much our kind of, I would say, our starting day game lineup. You've got the backup catcher in there. The only kind of substitution in there is the middle infield, which, again, we've seen Luis Rodriguez come in for Jack Wilson at second. We've seen Adam Kennedy start at second base. Really, the only out of this thing that we haven't even seen, and it's only been six games, is kind of both Kennedy and Rodriguez starting and Rodriguez playing shortstop. But what's cool about this is that and Jack Cust as the DH, all nine of those players can bat from the left side. You have four dedicated lefties and five switch hitters in that particular lineup, which I don't know. I'm sure it has been done because baseball's been around for a very long time. Very long time. But I personally cannot recall a time when any lineup has been nine left-handed hitters.
No. Absolutely
and
not.
That would just be so interesting to see.
And one of the things is, obviously, it's never going to happen. On Friday, in their home opener, the Mariners will go up against Cleveland's Justin Masterson. And because it's the home opener, Mariners are going to want to play as many of their own shitty regulars as they have. So they'll have Olivo in the lineup. They'll have Ryan and Wilson in the lineup. They'll try to put their best product on the field that they can because it's the home opener and they want to put on a show, even though I think we all know the kind of show the Mariners can put on when Felix isn't pitching. But what sucks about it is that Justin Masterson is a righty sinker baller with a very low arm angle. We've talked about him on the website before. He has a very broad platoon split. He's basically Sean Green as a starter, if you remember Sean Green, which you should, because he doesn't really throw strikes to lefties. He doesn't strike them out. He strike out to walk ratio is terrible. He probably gets a lot of ground balls, but basically he can't command the ball against left-handed batters very well for the count. So the Mariners, if they ran out nine lefties against him, you could have Justin Masterson out of the game in the third inning. Of course, they wouldn't because of the Mariners, and they would all swing into first and second pitch outs. But it would just be so, I think the word that occurs to me is it would be really exploratory. And like in a scientific way, I would like to pursue what could happen if the Mariners put nine left-handed batters up against Justin Masterson just to see. I mean, it would be a terrible game to watch just because it would take so long because he would have a lot of deep counts and foul balls and stuff. So it would drag. But I would just love to look at the box score for that game and see if Masterson comes out with like six walks and two strikeouts or whatever and get into the Cleveland bullpen, because I feel like our actual best chances of winning the game in the home opener would be to start this lineup, which Eric Wedge will never do.
I also think if we did win this game that and we did it in that fashion, it would just be so satisfying, because that is like the ultimate Angels way of winning a game, if I could use it in like that pejorative sense. It's just, it's so annoying. Could you imagine being on the other end of that sort of, like if we had to face another crappy hitting team. What's another crappy hitting team out there that we know is going to end up being crappy?
The Pirates?
Yeah, well, I was trying to think
of one. The Astros.
I know the Astros, but I was trying to think of one in the American League that, like, conceivable will play this year. But it's whatever.
The Rays. Okay,
but the Rays might actually not be terrible. But let's go with the Astros. It's the identity of the team doesn't matter. But it was like, you know, the Mariners were going to go play the Astros. We're all like, yeah, all right, we get to play the Astros. Terrible team. We could win some games. And, oh, hey, Michael Pineda's scheduled to start. It'd be awesome to watch him dominate a shitty lineup. Oh, wait, the Astros are going to run out 9 left-handed hitters. Come on. You're supposed to be bad. You found our one weakness against our starting pitcher. Like, that'd just be so irritating.
You know what's funny is when I'm watching the Mariners, unless Michael Saunders is batting, I never really pay attention to what handedness the pitcher is anyway. I just assume, okay, well, we're going to make an out. And with Saunders, it's like, well, he'll make a one pitch out or a three pitch out against a lefty or righty. But I don't really pay attention to it. But for a full game, I couldn't help but pay attention to it because I would be prepared for it. I go into it and I have this little game plan, things to watch for, and it's a shame that's never going to happen, just out of my own curiosity that Wedge won't do that. But it's cool to even have that possibility, and that means that on the bench, at least when we don't do that, we'll have so many different options where it's like, oh, hey, now the team has that flexibility that they wanted a year ago and then didn't have because they carried 2 DHs who couldn't hit.
Right. And I guess the other funny thing about that, the 9 left-handed lineup, is that they would still have either Langerhans or Saunders on the bench. So we'd have another lefty. We're not even maxing out our leftiness.
And we could always bring in Aaron Laffey to hit.
Yeah. There's like nothing more irritating in baseball than, I guess, like a switch hitter. Mm-hmm. Just in that kind of sense of like, oh, come on.
I think it was a few years ago the Angels were just, they were stocked up.
And that's why I correlate the two, that's just irritating. Like you can't get any advantage on the Angels just because, like, oh, whatever are you gonna bring in? Oh, you're gonna bring in this awesome ground ball pitcher? Well, now we're just gonna bunt for base hits all the time. A fly ball pitcher? Okay, we're just gonna dink Texas leaguers for hits all the time. And strikeout pitcher, whatever, we'll just foul off a bunch of balls until he's gotta go out because his pitch count's too high or now he's going to walk us. It's just, God.
We have such an
I want to be that team once. It's so much fun to win that way.
Yeah, like our home opener in 2009, right?
Right, yeah.
That was sloppier.
Winning on a uni bunt turned into an error.
Yeah, against the Angels.
Right. Now I want to see that, which has made me way more happier than I should be about an Adam Moore 60-day DL injury, but
yeah, sorry,
I don't know.
Adam.
Be way better, Adam Moore, because you've shown me nothing.
Yeah, it's hard to watch Adam Moore. And I mean, the guy, off the top of my head, he's what, 27, 28 years old?
Yeah, he's not young either.
It's a bummer, but then you realize, well, I mean, did we really have catching depth? We had Adam Moore, Rob Johnson, Jeff Clement in the system at the same time, and you know who just turned out the best? Rob Johnson. I don't trust catchers, and I don't trust catchers who have to learn to hit on the fly, and Adam Moore has shown no sense of understanding of the strike zone. He looks even more lost up there than Michael Saunders does, which is a hard thing to accomplish.
Right.
At least Saunders generally swings at strikes and just misses them.
Yes. Well, so we are 6 games into the season, as you've mentioned, 4 in a row in the loss column, but I can say with complete confidence that those 6 games are about 4% of the regular season.
I agree with you. I believe we've seen 3.7% of our regular season so far. And
likely there's a chance that we have seen more.
And I mean, we haven't been paying attention to the whole thing. So in the books there have been 3.7% of the expected regular season length. And over that 3.7% of the regular season, well, we've seen some good things and bad things, which may or may not serve as indications of what's to come in the future.
Would you like to name any of those things?
Well, so we have about 25 players that we've seen so far. in a game. As of Friday or Saturday, we could see 26. with Josh Bard. And what was, I guess, really the big things to focus on, the difference between this year and last year is that at least this year we don't just have one pitcher who's worth watching. So even if the Mariners are terrible, it shouldn't be like once every 5 days you kind of want to tune in for seven innings. But I also, it's so hard because it feels so familiar, this losing streak, and you don't want to get back in that same rut of being like, we're done and it's April. Because that just sucks, because then there's another 5 months of baseball that you kind of pay attention to, you kind of don't. And it's not fair because, I mean, you look, the Yankees have been struggling, the Reds, a lot of good teams have been struggling, and the Astros won today. So, like, anything can happen in a week of baseball.
But yeah.
It's still, because it's the only information that we have that's been
in. It's hard not to dwell on it.
Yeah. Because it's before the year, I would look at this lineup and think, hey, I see the upside in this lineup. This lineup could hit. I like a lot of the play. I don't love the players in the lineup, but like I can see this actually being like a somewhat annoying lineup to face. And then we watched the last four games, like, oh yeah, no,
yeah, it's annoying for us, not for the other team.
Almost immediately, I see that we're not going to score runs again, and right. That isn't fair because I mean no. The Rays have 8 runs in 6 games. That is silliness. So who knows? But it's just, I guess maybe we're just so ready to accept being shitty that we don't fight it when it starts to settle in. But man, we could really use like a 10-run outburst followed yes. by a 10-run outburst.
That would certainly do a lot of things. And I would say, so it's tough to get swept also when you get to toss out Bedard, Pineda, and Felix. And obviously there's limitations to our expectations coming in for Bedard and Pineda that we're all aware of, but I think on the offensive side, it's important to keep in mind that the Mariners, we've played 6 games, 4 of the opposing starting pitchers have been left-handed, and this is not a lineup, especially with Gutierrez out, that's built to beat southpaws. This is, you know, we have the first 5 in our lineup being kind of Ichiro, Figgins, Bradley, Cust, and Smoke. That's, you know, 2 lefties, 3 switch hitters. No. I've already forgotten.
Oh, you're right. Figgins, Bradley, Smoke.
Figgins. I always forget that either Figgins or Bradley are both switch hitters. I think probably because Figgins is not actually a switch hitter. He'll stand on either side of the plate, but he doesn't actually do the hitting part.
Is he standing? Is that how tall he is?
I don't know. whatever it is that he's doing up there. But so that's a lineup when they get to face righties can present quite a bit of a problem, because not only is that 5 lefties in a row when you're facing a right-handed hitter, but it's not, you know, Figgins notwithstanding, and I don't think he's this bad. That's 5 at least annoying left-handed hitters to face, especially now that we've kind of buoyed our expectations, or at least the first 6 games have kind of allayed some of our fears about Justin Smoke. He's had a very favorable first 2 series, mm-hmm. especially at the plate. But so with the good thing is this upcoming series is Cleveland's. They've got 3 righties penciled in. Justin. Wait a minute. Justin Masterson's not starting the opener.
What?
I don't believe so. I believe it's Carlos Carrasco.
Oh, well,
now that I think about it. Okay. So it's Carrasco, Masterson, and then Josh Tomlin.
Yeah, I don't know.
Who nobody should know because, well, there's no reason to know him. He pitches for the Indians. But the important thing is that all 3 of them are right-handed. And then following the Cleveland series, we get 3 against Toronto, and we should only, I believe, face 1 lefty in that series. And then we get to go face the Royals for 4 games. And they're, I think, only running a 4-man rotation in the first month of the season anyways, but it's the Royals, so you kind of have an idea of who we get to face. So, Jeff, that's the next 10 games. Mm-hmm. 5 of the 6 will be against righties, and then it's 2 righties and 2 lefties, but it's in Kansas City against the Royals. What are we going to be saying about the Mariners offense 10 games from now?
Well, I don't think we're going to be saying the things that we're saying about them now.
That would be weird, because then we'd be talking about 2 weeks in the past, and I don't know why we'd be saying that still.
Yeah, we're actually going to recite the exact same words. We're going to practice this. But what will we be saying? I think we'll be saying that we have watched this offense in 10 consecutive, very boring, borderline unwatchable games. Because Cleveland, Oakland, and Kansas City is pretty much...
Cleveland, Toronto, Kansas City.
Oh, sorry, Cleveland, Toronto. I don't know why I assumed Oakland, but okay, Toronto's a little better.
Because you said you were thinking boring, and you went right to Oakland.
Yeah, Cleveland games are boring. Royals games are boring and humiliating, inevitably. Toronto's a little more fun. But Toronto's got a good pitching staff. Cleveland, not so much. And Kansas City, certainly not so much. So we'll have a lineup that will have scored at least 5 runs in a game on its own without relying on a bunch of errors. That should happen. We'll see some at least. I'm going to go out on a limb and predict at least 3 home runs in the 10 games to come, total. More likely, I would really like to see a home run a game. I know that's asking a lot, especially coming home for a little bit. But God, I just miss dingers so bad. And we've talked so much these last few years about how you don't need them to win, but they're nice to have.
Right.
Sometimes, especially with a Jack Custon. I think what could happen, let's say the Mariners lose 95-100 games this year. We get to the end, Jack Huss has like a 730 OPS. We're going to look at him and be like, yeah, actually, we should have seen that coming, just based on his numbers and his trends. Like, if Huss actually is not the power output that we would like him to be this year, I don't think we can be that surprised.
No.
There's a lot of situations in this lineup where if they do poorly, we can be like, yeah, no, that makes sense.
Right.
There's nothing out of the blue like Figgins last year. Of course, Figgins now, it would make sense if he struggled because we just saw him do that.
Yeah.
But last year, nobody would have figured that Figgins would do that or that whoever else was terrible would be terrible. Bradley. We didn't think Bradley would do that, but now yeah. It makes sense. Like, oh, Ichiro getting older, Figgins terrible, cussed. Numbers trending down. Bradley couldn't hit. Smoke, rookie. Olivo, no patience. Wilson can't hit. Ryan can't hit. Saunders is a bust. Langerhans is a bench player. Gutierrez is sick. Like, oh, man, I wish I hadn't had that train of thought. Because I'm depressed. Man. So it's easy to see that this lineup could end up being really bad. But it's still early, so we still have a little optimism. And maybe it won't be. And these next 10 days would be really nice to see them warm up with the weather a little bit. I would like to see 45 runs in these 10 games. I will settle for 40, I guess.
I think they do 45. I think they go more than that. And I'm going to say they hit maybe 7 or 8 home runs over the 10 games. I'm actually pretty optimistic. And that's the thing is maybe it's just because I haven't gotten beat into it or that I'm fighting against the acceptance of them being shitty again, but I hesitate to use the word I believe in this lineup because I believe in this lineup to score 4 runs a game, which is really still bad, but I do believe that they are substantially better than last year and that even though it hasn't shown itself so much over the first six games, even though the numbers look very much like all 2010, it does feel kind of different to me. I haven't gone and looked this up, but I feel like the team's batting average with runners in scoring position and those kind of metrics would just be off the charts awful right now. Mm-hmm. To a point where there's no way you'd expect it to continue. Like if you told me that the team was hitting 150 with runners in scoring position, I'd be like, that sounds right. And so I think some more runs are gonna score. And yeah, that doesn't really change the triple slash line, which looks terrible as well, but again, it's early in the season. Offense production's usually down. It's colder out. Ball doesn't travel as far. They were starting on the road. They played 3 in Oakland, which is not a great place to play if you want to score runs. Yeah, they played 3 in Texas, but 3 in Texas in early April is a lot different from 3 in Texas in August. And they faced some good pitching in Texas, and they faced, I mean, Oakland's got good pitching too. So, and again, with the lefties. So, I don't want to draw any conclusions yet, and I don't want it to diminish any of my hope. And looking at the next 10 games, I think, I don't know if we'll be podcasting exactly 10 games from now, but I think we'll sit back after whatever recap you wrote for that game, and I'm going to say we're going to be no worse than 500. We'll be no worse than 8-8. I think we take 6 out of the next 10, at least. And we look at it, and the offense is, like, I would say maybe slightly below league average. And at that point, we start to be like, okay, maybe this lineup's not going to be good, and it's probably not even going to be average. but we're starting to get a sense that it, I don't think it's going to be a black hole. And I think that would just be a tremendous relief to us. So that's where I think we're going to be in 10 games.
That that four runs a game Ron Fairley special is pretty much exactly a 650 run pace. Which
it's 670, isn't he?
648.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they'll just round it to 650. And of course, 650 is bad. That is a bad run total for a team offense. But it's also 137 more runs than it's almost a run a game more than the Mariners scored last year. Which, granted, a run another run a game from 2010 feels like we scored one run in a game, but it's a substantial difference, especially when you factor in the ballpark and playing games in Oakland and Anaheim as well. But all right, I see your optimism, and I'm gonna try to get into it. there was something insightful I was gonna say that I completely missed out. Oh, you said that the offense has felt a little different, even though the raw slash line, I'm sorry, has been so similar to last year. But what I've talked about and what a lot of people have noticed, certainly in the Texas series, is that when the team has gone down, they have battled back, and I know it's only been three games, but it doesn't have that feel yet of like, oh, they gave up three runs, we're fucked. Because now it's like, well, no, so what's going to happen is we gave up three runs, so we'll score two, and then we'll
and strand a third runner. Yeah, it feels a little different, even though possibly the end result's the same. And that it's too early to tell whether that's just kind of, hey, it's April and it's not June yet, so we're tricking our brains into making it feel differently, or there does seem to be a little bit more pluck in the offense.
Yeah. Unfortunately, so Sean Figgins seems to be like ending every rally that the Mariners have, just based on my own subjective experience. And having him right behind Ichiro right now, I feel like we just saw the Rangers take advantage of this yesterday where they walked Ichiro in a big situation, brought up Figgins, and then Figgins, like, he either tapped out of the mound or he tapped out to short or one of those. He pretty much hit the crap out of the ball for Sean Figgins, and then he ended the rally. And I wonder if teams will continue to take advantage of that or if they'll be afraid to put Ichiro on base. I don't know how teams actually perceive Sean Figgins at this point because he was so dangerous with the Angels that maybe that's still in managers' heads. So I would really like to know how the Angels would approach him. Oh, that'll be fun to look at.
Hmm.
But having him behind Ichiro, it seems like it's you don't expect Sean Figgins to hurt you, basically, if you're an opposing manager. The worst he's going to do is walk or single, not unlike a pitcher. So I will be interested to see what Ichiro's plate discipline numbers look like and how he's being pitched. Certainly, last year, I don't think we investigated this too much when Ichiro was only one of the only players capable of hitting. Where I should also go back and investigate how he was pitched last year and see if there was any difference. But it seems like the door is open there as long as Figgins is batting behind him and as long as Figgins is being bad.
Yeah, I gotta say, among all the people on the team, there's probably nobody I'm rooting harder to succeed than Sean Figgins. Just we're tied to that contract and. He can play third base. That's at least is for sure. And if he could just return to, obviously, 2009 would be amazing, but not even 2009. If he could just return to being a slightly below average offensive threat, that's a huge boost to this lineup, especially behind Ichiro with his speed. And then you kind of have those two table setters for Bradley, who is doing well so far. It's nice to say. Especially with Saunders looking like the way he is, and Cust behind them. And I think Cust becomes a lot more dangerous of a hitter when he's hitting with runners already on base, and now pitchers have to kind of decide between do I want to pitch around him, but then he's likely to just take a ball, and I don't want to walk him, and grooving him. So if they're trying to shy away from throwing him balls, then the pitchers kind of tend to congregate more in the middle of the plate, and maybe he gets meatier stuff to hit. You know, there is an element to chaining, I think, in lineups, as much as we talk about them as independent events. But you know, if you get runners on base, it's easier for the hitters to hit. So it's very hard right now with Sean Figgins batting the way he is in the number two slot. He really needs to get a lot better, and it would just be so much nicer if he would show us something where it could at least cling to you know, it's not even the Adrian Beltre slumps where it's just, God, he's hitting the ball on a line and it's always getting caught. And even Casey Kochman, to a point, when he was doing that, it was like, man, this guy's got no power, but at least he's stinging line drives and it's always right at the first baseman. But I just, it's, yeah, you watch Sean Figgins, it's like, how does he even get the ball out of the infield?
Yeah, this is, so we've talked about this before, and we're going to talk about this probably a lot in the future, it's been brought up, but you watch Sean Figgins now, and we watched Sean Figgins a lot when he was an opponent, but we didn't watch him all the time, we only watched him 18, 19 times a year, or if there was a bad year, like 6 or 7 times before we stopped watching. And then you watch him now, and it's like, how did this guy do what he did for the Angels? I literally can't understand how he got so many balls to find the ground outside of the infield. Like, how did he find spots? How did he hit the ball hard enough, consistently enough? When I think of Sean Figgins right now, the image that comes into my head is that pop-up that he hits behind the infield, that one of the infielders catches, and he goes back, and there's no player, Figgins and Saunders, I guess, are like the two players on the CMI I have no faith in. If there's like a man on third in less than 2 outs, because I assume Saunders will strike out and Figgins will pop out or something.
Right.
I even trust Miguel Levo because he's actually come through a few times and he's the worst approach. Because Miguel Levo, well, we don't need to talk about Miguel Levo's approach right now, but I feel like I should go back and watch old film of Sean Figgins, which I would do if it weren't such a bitch to load up a bunch of MLB TV windows and scroll the Figgins at bats and then go through all 8 pitches that he saw before he put the ball in play. Like, that doesn't sound like fun. But you just look at the swing, it's like, I don't get it. How?
I don't know. Maybe he needs to go to the gym or something. Hit the weights.
You know what Sean Figgins does in the gym is get bench pressed.
It's weird, but let's not dwell on the negative. How about Jack Wilson? Obviously, we're not going to proclaim him revitalized after 6 games or anything like that, but he looks noticeably more spry out there.
Yeah. Jack Wilson is running around just like Jack Wilson in my head did when he was younger with the Pirates. And with his ability to put the bat on the ball, I actually like him. This is weird. I have a little faith in Wilson as a hitter because he's so adept at putting the ball in play. And he hits the ball not hard, but like hard enough that he can hit these line drives. I kind of think of Jack Wilson the same way that I think of Freddie Sanchez at the plate, which I understand maybe a lot of people don't think about Freddie Sanchez at the plate because he's never been a Mariner or in the American League, except for the Red Sox. But I feel like Jack Wilson could just come up and he can hit the ball just over the shortstop set or just in the hole between first and second base. He's never going to hit a bunch of extra base hits, but he doesn't swing it too much trash. He has a level swing. He'll hit the ball on the line, and he makes terrific plays in the field. Wednesday aside, that...
Yeah,
this is a way I haven't felt about Jack Wilson since he came over to the Mariners.
You know what's interesting is if you took that description that you just did and you copied and pasted it 14 months ago, you know who that would sound exactly like?
Ichiro.
No.
Figgins.
Sean Figgins. Sounds exactly like Sean Figgins. At least the image that I had in my head when we signed him away from the Angels. That's what he did.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't... Yeah, he's not going to hit for extra bases, but he's that type of guy who's just going to hit those little... He hits the ball just hard enough, and it gets, you know, over the infield and in front of the outfield, and sometimes he hits it down the line or into the gap, or just has enough, you know, space away from the fielder that his speed lets him get a double. Sometimes it gets to the wall, and it's a triple, and that's Sean Figgins, and he's good at defense, and, like, that's the whole game. And it's weird to me that... Because I agree, that's how I also think about Jack Wilson when he's healthy. Mm-hmm. And the great thing is, yeah, that's not a good hitter. But when it's paired with a good fielder, that's an overall good player, or at least an average player. Mm-hmm. And when that's like your 9 hitter or your 8 hitter, that's what I think makes the lineup way more tolerable. When it's basically that's your worst hitter, mm-hmm, is a Jack Wilson. Like, Sean Figgins, I don't think would be so garnering so much animosity if he was batting 8th or 9th. Mm-hmm. I think it's the fact that he's batting 2nd. And that's not to say let's move Sean Figgins down to 7, 8, or 9, although that there's some merit to that idea. And not to excuse, I mean, Sean Figgins just needs to hit better. And he's capable of it too, as far as we know. Mm-hmm. But I think it going just what I'm trying to do is tie it back into the why I think this so far feels more hopeful or at least different than 2010 is that 2010 really felt like watching Ichiro and then 8 Jack Wilsons. And at least this time we now have Ichiro and some other people. And then it's like, then 3 Jack Wilsons, like 7, 8, 9 feels like Jack Wilson, but at least that's the bottom of the order. And at least that can be kind of pesky.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things where it's like, hey, if somebody, and if they don't go 1, 2, 3, oh, hey, somebody's on base and then it's Ichiro. And it's not just like, oh, well then they pitch around Ichiro and then it's 8 more Jack Wilsons. It's, you know, it makes the whole thing feel different when that's the bottom of your order rather than your entire batting order, even if the end result is the same for now.
I got to say, I kind of look forward to Miguel Oliva's at-bats, even though he looks ridiculous when, I mean,
he swings at everything.
He swings at everything, but like when he, at least so far, whatever, 6 games, however many games of those he's played, when he like swings at a strike, he hits strikes. He's not completely hopeless. It's when pitchers start taking advantage of him.
Yeah.
I remember I did have MLB TV when he was a Mariner before, and I mean, he just never got strikes, and he didn't know. So it seems like pitchers are kind of too stupid to know how they're supposed to pitch to Miguel Oliva when he takes advantage. But I mean, when he comes up to the plate, who knows? You know, there's this air of mystery where
right, he can hit a home run at least.
Yeah, he could hit a ball 450 feet. Sometimes he'll do that once or twice this year. He'll hit his home runs, and you just don't know. So it's nice to have that possibility where Sean Figgins is one of 2 Mariners to hit a home run this year. And I will never, a year from now, I will insist that that memory is incorrect. Sean Figgins hit a home run because I would never expect him to even hit a ball 250 feet.
Yeah, no, that one's etched in my mind simply because I actually jokingly called a Figgins home run before it happened. I was pretty drunk.
You don't say. Where were you in the Langerhans homer?
I think I was at work. But
6 games in, no cust, no smoke, no Olivo.
Yeah,
Langerhans and Figgins.
Right. The interesting thing about Miguel Olivo is how we've already seen probably 2 of the most unusual Miguel Olivo events in what's been, 4, maybe 5 games that he's played. We saw the unintentional walk, which is like, whoa. And when that happened, I wasn't even paying attention because I think with Miguel Olivo, even when he has a 3-ball count, it was never like, oh, he could walk here. The idea that that could happen didn't even really enter my mind. It's like he had to get to a 3.5-ball count. Like, it has to be a 3-ball count, and I see the pitch, and I'm like, that's way outside. He could walk here.
Yeah, they're pitching out.
He might draw a walk, guys. But so I wasn't even really paying attention when all of a sudden it was like, oh, ball 4. And also, our team draws a lot of walks. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, yeah, another walk. Wait a minute. That was Olivo. Sweet. But also, beyond that, was a couple games later, you remarked how he got called out on strikes. Mm-hmm. And I think that's all you just said. It was like, wow, Miguel Olivo just got called out on strikes. He actually – so he got called out on strikes on a 5-pitch at bat. He swung at none of them. It wasn't just a called strikeout. He took 2 balls and he took 3 strikes, which might be more rare than an unintentional walk. I'm now curious to see what is the longest at bat Miguel Olivo has gone without swinging. And I could look this up, actually.
Yeah, you should look that up and you could make a little post about it. You could make a post about it before this podcast is up.
I could, conceivably, yes.
But So I didn't really notice the Olivo walk when it happened. It took me a minute to register because the game thread picked up on it. So I was like, oh, whoa, wow. But I will say, as excited that I am that Olivo drew that walk, it's kind of a bummer that it happened so quick because I was looking forward to it as something to keep me entertained in like middle of May. Like, nope, still not. It's going to happen, but he hasn't done it yet.
Well,
and then it could be like this celebratory moment where I don't have to write a recap. I can just talk about his walk and it saves me hours of time or whatever.
But like the time. No. The time Uni finally drew a walk and you got to update the... I saw that again, and wow, that really put a lot of things in perspective because that was Uni at 0, Ichiro at 0, and Jamie Moyer at like 4.
4 walks for Jamie Moyer. I don't even remember... Wow. How were they walking Jamie... You know who I... Jamie Moy and Sean Viggins at the plate. Who hits the ball further?
Like right now with Moyer's busted up elbow?
Yeah, but he's rested.
I don't. Yeah, I'm probably Sean Viggins. I mean, we did see him hit a home run. In Oakland.
I mean, and it got out of there by at least, I don't know, 10, 15 feet. He had a pretty good right down the line, granted, but it wasn't even
right down the line. It was sort of to left field. It was a solid left field. I'm not going to claim it was in the gap or anything, but it wasn't like a Jose Lopez special.
Yeah, I got that staircase or that whatever that ramp is, right? Behind the wall in Oakland, one of several ramps.
Right. Well, the entire thing is ramps. They might as well replace all the seats with ramps.
Mount Davis is so cool.
I was just making a poor attendance joke. That's cool. I know. It's fine too.
But I just wanted to think about Mount Davis, mostly because it's just so intimidating out there. It's always looking at you, like judging you, like I'm above you and you will never hit a ball this far. It's like maybe that's part of their advantage at home. Like Oakland is over, they're already down on themselves because they're terrible, but then other hitters come in, they're like, oh, I can hit that thing. No, you can't. Because it's closer than it is. It's actually just so big. It's like Mount Rainier from Seattle, where it's like 35 miles away, but it looks like you can touch it. You can't touch it. You can't come close to touching it. You have to go on a long drive. You have to drive to Mount Davis to be able to touch it.
Mount Rainier's a lot further away than 35 miles.
I think from the edges of Seattle, it's 35 as the crow flies. I think I just read that.
Well, I guess I would defend on where the edge of Seattle. I mean, maybe. Maybe.
I just wanted. I've never actually said where as the crow flies out loud. I don't think I've even typed it before. But I've seen it in various similar expressions so often lately. I wanted to throw it in there. But it's alarmingly. It's not alarmingly close. Well, you could consider it alarmingly close when it goes off.
You know, yeah, I was going to say, you know what would be alarmingly close is if I woke up one day and it was closer. That would be alarming.
Uh-oh.
So let's talk about the bullpen. The bullpen. It's been six games, but we've got to see all seven members of the bullpen now.
Yeah.
And clearly, so far, David Pauly's been the worst.
Yeah, Pauly's been...
Yeah, he's faced nine batters, which, again, it's only nine, but he has three walks, three line drives allowed, he's hit a guy, he's got no strikeouts.
Yeah.
So, Jeff, is David Pauly the worst pitcher of all time?
I think, based on the evidence we have collected to date, David Pauly is unquestionably the second worst pitcher of all time behind Kevin Jarvis. But aside from those two, also, I have memories of Scott Carl being really bad, but he was a Rocky in the 90s, so I think I'm missing something there. He was probably at the ballpark.
I have to feel Kevin Jarvis eventually pitched for the Padres, right?
Yeah, I believe we traded him there.
Yeah. In my mind, he can't be the worst pitcher of all time because anybody who pitches for the Padres becomes automatically not bad.
Kevin Jarvis with the Padres had a 5.06 ERA, but more than twice as many strikeouts as, holy shit, he was okay.
Point proven.
With the Mariners, however, he allowed 12 runs in 13 innings.
Yeah. I mean, if we want to talk about, like, worst Mariner impression, we could talk about Bob White or
Matt White.
John Parrish.
John Parrish.
Who was another guy who was just really, really unlucky. John Parrish, if I recall... It was 2007, was not actually that bad. He just had like this 400 ball and play average and couldn't strand a runner to save his life. Unlike Bob White, who just walked everybody.
Do you mean Bob Wells?
No, Rick White.
Rick White.
Rick White. Rick whatever. White.
Yeah, the
he looked guy, like a Bob.
Guy who introduced us to going through wars, I believe. Rick White threw. He only threw 5 1/3 innings with the Mariners, and we will never, aside from you forgetting his name, we will never forget Rick White as a Mariner. Those six games, because he basically capped off the season with that bases loaded walk, and because he flipped off the umpire in the same game or whatever it was that he did. I don't even know if he really flipped him off, but it was just him and the words that were used about him at the acquisition. Like,
yes.
That was quite the impression. And then you compare that to Chris Jakubauskas, who I still don't think actually pitched for the Mariners. He actually threw like 100 innings.
He's there, like, now just – he's like a pre-Doug Fister Doug Fister. His memory of Chris Jackie Bosses has just melded with Doug Fister, and now I just think Doug Fister's been with the team for a lot longer because yeah, they're kind of the same person, except Fister's got better control, but tall, gainly-looking white guys who know stuff.
Yeah.
Man, they're really the same people.
I did that post, I don't remember when I did it, about pitchers that I forgot through as many innings as I did. I think Jack Abascus was the guy who made me think of it. And then, of course, there's David Pauly and his, like, 90 innings yesterday that caught me. I had no idea.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, this is Jason Vargas' third year, which doesn't really feel like it is. He's established now. I guess you were getting off track as you were talking about the bullpen, right? But, hey, Randy Messenger. Remember Randy Messenger?
Who could forget Randy Messenger? I mean, I don't remember him pitching. I can't forget Randy Messenger just because of how much Aaron hated Randy Messenger, which Aaron is my only lasting memory. So thanks, Aaron, for making me remember Randy Messenger.
Over the bullpen, David Pauly. Yes. Not the worst pitcher of all time because of Kevin Jarvis.
But has anybody, so aside from David Pauly's not worst sucking, has anyone left you with a strong impression? I mean, Josh Lucchese certainly showed some dominant movement.
Yeah, and so what gets me excited about having watched Lucchese, even though he struggled in that game, is he threw a few breaking balls that they went exactly where he wanted them to. Really good movement. He got the swing and strikes on them. And you can see in that pitch, okay, Josh Lucchese, when he gets settled, he's going to miss bats. He's going to be a threat. Maybe not so much against lefties, but he should because he has a splitter too. But Lucchese should be, when he gets better, a very, very good reliever. Dan Cortez, when I saw him last year and in spring, I wasn't so sure because he doesn't have that. I don't like his curveball that much because it's kind of wild. So I like Lucchese. Well, Helmsen, we've barely seen, so it's hard to say. I mean, we've seen all the relievers, but we've barely seen all the relievers.
Yes.
Really. But, I mean, God, even Jamie Wright is getting the job done, and I think it is time that we say once again, Jamie Wright is not a terrible reliever. He is just not a good reliever.
He's just mediocre and he's old. Yeah. But if he's your sixth guy in the bullpen, then whatever. He gets ground balls.
Yeah, he gets a lot of ground balls.
Yeah, he does something at least.
It's Laffy we should complain about.
Yeah, but he's new, so whatever. And they got to have all lefty, I guess.
And, God, League, whatever. League is League. He's actually, so far, he's seemed to be throwing a lot of splitters. They just haven't been good, which is concerning. He's missing a lot with it.
And well, maybe it's because he didn't throw any of them last year.
Maybe. Let's call up Luke French, and he'll be like, a slider? I don't know where this is going to go. I've never thrown this before. Yes, you have. You threw it when you were good. Then you stopped throwing it, and then you were bad. Bring it back. So now League has to like go through his own spring training to find the slider or the splitter again. But what I like about the bullpen is right now there's a lot of question marks, a lot of uncertainty, a lot of people I really don't want to have to watch. But then you have Arthur coming back, you have Kelly coming back. Who knows if Cortez or anybody else from that whole group in Tacoma can do. This could conceivably be a decent bullpen by the end of the year, although Arthur could be traded. I mean, it would be really nice to see Sean Kelly settle in and get his ERA under 4 or whatever.
Yeah, well, if he does, if he comes back and then you've potential... well, obviously Ardsma, who I've already totally kind of forgotten about, but he's got to be coming back pretty soon. But in addition to him, you could have Cortez if he takes a step forward with his command, or Robles if he takes a step forward with his command. And yeah, the bullpen could get, we say this every time, the bullpen could get interesting in a hurry.
Yeah. I mean, even now it's...
I mean, it's already kind of interesting, but it could get interesting in a good way.
Yeah. It'll... if you think of if Arthur and Kelly come back and they're healthy and they're all in the same bullpen at the same time, there's a lot of hard-throwing righties in there that could actually turn that into a strength. And, of course, this is bullpen, so you never want to issue any kind of prediction because that's just a fool's errand. But
right. It's
there. I mean, we don't have such a bad bullpen that it's like, no, best-case scenario is they're all basically Jimmy Wright because that would be bad. Like, there's actual ability down there, which is really all you can really ask for from a bullpen because the Mariners aren't a team that's going to bring in a bunch of established relievers, and even if they were, turns out established relievers aren't really that predictable anyway. The only team with a great bullpen year in, year out that's predictably great is the Padres, and they're amazing all the time, no matter who they have.
I think it's just, well, it's not just but yeah, damn that ballpark.
That ballpark. It'll be interesting, actually. Kevin Towers, who was a genius with building what seemed to be strong Padres bullpens. And now he's in Arizona, who had pretty much the worst bullpen of all time last season.
Yes.
So we'll see what happens there. But J.J. Putz, I really like him as a bounce. Well, not even a bounce back candidate, because he was really good last year. But
yeah, it was a savvy pickup.
Yeah.
So one thing that just kind of occurred to me when we were talking about Josh Lucchese, so Josh Lucchese struck out the first batter he faced, I think on three pitches? Maybe four?
Three or four, yeah.
Yeah. Michael Pineda struck out the first batter he faced on three pitches. And Williamson got a tapper, basically a comeback or ground out in the first batter he faced. All those major league debuts we saw in the first couple games of the season. So clearly, I think we need to just field pitchers only making major league debuts for the rest of the season.
This is Mamba Rivera's time to shine.
that's basically what our bullpen should just be. It's just nobody, only people making major league debuts. So, you know, get rid of our entire bullpen.
We're going to have to carry Felix and like 20 guys.
You get to face one batter and then you're done.
Fortunately, this is why the organization brought in Sean Casmar, because he can play seven positions at once. So then he's really handy to have off the bench and starting, because he can do both at the same time. But having been a professional baseball player, I don't know how great it feels for Wilhelmsen to have a shutout debut inning, Lucchese to strike out the first guy, Pineda to have such a great first inning. But, I mean, you talk about a nice way to get your feet wet and just get settled immediately. Like, any jitters? Lucchese had kind of a bad inning, but there was some bad luck in there, too, and I think you know that he threw good pitches. He got a couple strikeouts, so he'll feel pretty confident. I'm not worried about either of these guys, certainly with the way Pineda came out and just dominated in that first inning. Like, okay, that's it. He's not going to struggle because he's a rookie. He's going to struggle because of his changeup, but he's ready to be here. There's no question in my mind.
Yeah, it's exactly. He needs that changeup, but once he gets that changeup, man, I mean, his... let's talk about the rotation. So, you know, Felix, Bedard, Pineda, kind of the big stories, as always, just kind of Pineda in his debut, Bedard in his quasi-debut, and Felix just because he's Felix. And sticking with Pineda, I think a lot of people who either hadn't seen the game or whatever and came in, you know, kept asking, like, how does Pineda look and whatever. And for the most part, I think what I kept saying is that Pineda showed me exactly what I expected to see. And that's not entirely true. Rationally, based on the scouting reports we had, the minor league numbers, Michael Pineda was what I expected. But emotionally, I'm never comfortable with any farm system product from the Mariners to live up to their expectations, as we've seen with every hitter that has ever come up through the Mariners organization. So I think in my lizard brain part, my subconscious, I downgrade them whenever we promote somebody. So I'm expecting less than I should probably expect. Which is, you know, good self-defense mechanism and all that kind of helps keep the suicidal thoughts at bay. But Pineda did not live up to that distrust. And he exactly lived up to pretty much what we thought he would be. If he was on any other team and I had known about him and saw him come up and saw him pitch that game, I'd have been like, yep. And as that's pretty much what I think our collective blogosphere reaction was. Yeah. He can destroy righties. We saw good fastball. We saw good movement on the slider. We saw potentially good movement on the changeup. He can't locate it, and lefties can sit on that fastball, and they can tee off on the slider because it comes at kind of a low angle. So he needs that changeup. We saw nothing new. That start told us nothing, really, about Michael Pineda that we didn't already know. So in that sense, yes, that was exactly what I expected to see. I guess what did surprise me, though, is to see how much that product actually worked in the major leagues. I was more skeptical of how the whole package would actually translate to Major League Baseball. And granted, again, it's been one start, and that was a kind of right-handed heavy lineup. So, you know, I'm not looking forward to seeing him have to face Joe Mauer, Justin Morneau, and Jim Thome sort of back-to-back-to-back. But I will say his control really surprised me. He threw a lot of strikes. He was very efficient. We saw him just cruising through that game until the sixth. And that part was, you always kind of expect, especially a hard-throwing rookie when they come up, to be wild, to be amped. You mentioned this as well, I think, that we totally expected him to have jitters, be overthrowing the fastball, maybe spin a few sliders or throw him in the dirt because he's trying extra hard or whatever. Didn't really happen for the most part. He was hitting his spots, and he was hitting spots on the edge of the strike zone. And, man, if he can do that, he's got stuff, and he can live in that area. I can see why he's rated so highly.
Yeah. It's one thing to have a good fastball and then inconsistent breaking pitches. And then because you throw hard, people will say, oh, that guy has good stuff. He just needs to harness it. Pineda has that classic prospect good stuff description, but his slider is good enough that he does have two weapons that are consistent, at least against righties. And he throws so hard, he's so domineering looking on the mound, that it's clear when you watch Michael Pineda, even if you're not a Mariners fan, it's like, okay, this guy very obviously has the capability to become an ace. And one of those dominant, this guy is just so awesome to watch kind of aces, where so this is very, very rare for me to do during a Mariners game, but watching Pineda, like when he struck out Kinsler, when he struck out Hamilton, I like cheered. I gave him a standing ovation when he struck out Hamilton, because it's just so much fun to watch a guy like that, as opposed to a guy who's just, like, mixes up cutters and throws changeups and gets the job done. It's like, no, I like the classic closer image. I like the fireballers. Like, I like the guys who overpower you, and then they mix in this devastating breaking ball, and Pineda is just, I didn't even care that the Mariners lost. Like, as soon as that game was over, I didn't give a shit, because literally all I wanted, I didn't want the Mariners to hit. I just wanted to watch Michael Pineda pitch, and he was a lot of fun. And you were touching on how bad it's going to be, for example, to watch him face Mauer, Morneau, and Tomei, and it is worth considering. As much, we've made a huge deal out of this platoon split that he has, that he's going to have for a while. But, of course, what comes as a side effect of that is that everybody's going to become indoctrinated with this idea, and they'll think, okay, Pineda's great against righties, struggles against lefties, and then people are going to overreact to it, and they'll make his platoon split bigger than it is. They'll say, oh, Pineda's dominant against righties, but he's shit against lefties. He's got to get better. That's not true. He's good against righties. He'll be frustrating against lefties. He's not going to get lit up by lefties, because he does still have good stuff, even if it's inconsistent. He'll have a high OBP against. He'll probably give up bunch of extra base hits, but it's not like he's not Sean Green, you know? He throws hard.
He's not worthless.
Yeah. He'll get the job done against lefties. It'll just prevent him from becoming an ace until he has that changeup.
Yes. But I think it's clear he's a major league caliber pitcher right now.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, for God's sake, we have Doug Fister in this I was about to say relationship, but I meant to say rotation.
Yeah.
Doug Fister. No poor relationships for Doug Fister. Yeah.
Poor Fister and Vargas. They're just so blah. especially if you contrast them with Felix and Pineda and Bedard. Even though Bedard doesn't have the lightning stuff, he's got just that curveball, and he's got that eternal hope sexiness sort of thing. That, yeah. I mean, what Fister or Vargas would need to throw like some sort of crazy no-hitter or something to get attention, because...
No, hold on. I'm going to interrupt you here, because I think Luke French had about two dozen starts last year. We had no hit the opponent for six innings. Like, I don't care. Like, somebody would tell me that.
Complete a no-hitter.
I'm still going here. I was out one time at a bar, and somebody told me, oh, Felix has a no-hitter through six. And I was like, shit, I got to get home.
Yeah.
I was out at a bar. Somebody told me, Luke French has a no-hitter through six. And I was like, okay. I don't care. I don't care, because it's not going to happen. Yeah.
Right.
I know it would be different if it did happen, but if Luke French threw a perfect game for the Mariners, for some reason he's starting, if he threw a perfect game, the next time he came out, I'd be like, oh, Luke French is that bad starter who threw a perfect game, just like John Halama in the PCL 10 years ago.
Yeah, no. I'm not saying that they would that Fister or Vargas throwing this like crazy no-hitter would change our perception of them going forward, but it would at least get them some attention.
Okay,
is all
that's
I'm
true.
Saying. Because otherwise, if we're going to talk about like the pitchers that interest us and who we're going to do, you know, like you, if you go back at the end of this year and you tally up like how many articles we end up writing on Felix, on Michael Pineda, on Eric Bedard, they're going to dwarf the number of articles we're going to write that are solely specifically on Doug Fisher or Jason Vargas.
Well, that's because Doug Fisher's going to be back in the minors in June.
I mean, like, the number of articles we might write focusing on Jason Vargas might be zero.
He
could spend the whole year with the team, and we might not ever really, you know, we'll touch on him, and you'll mention him in the recaps when he pitches. But as far as, like, a post where we look at, like, Michael Pineda's changeup, and we'll obviously be tracking that very closely throughout the year, or when I talked about Felix and O2 counts on this, we're never going to care about Doug Fisher or Jason Vargas to that level.
Tracking Doug Fister's fastball. Yep, still hittable.
Right, you know? But this at least, hey, if they threw a new hitter, I would at least have to write a post about that.
That's true. It's probably not a coincidence they had to act together in the same commercial.
Right. Exactly.
You know what they should have done in that commercial? Is they have Jason Vargas and Doug Fister stand up facing the camera next to each other, and then they put their names under them. Hey, this is Doug Fisher. This is Jason Vargas. And then, so they're standing there in their street clothes. And then somebody off camera hands them jerseys, Mariners jerseys. They put them on, they turn around, and they show, these are Vargas and Fisher Mariners jerseys, implying these are players on the team, by the way. But I enjoy Vargas, actually. I enjoy his games. Fisher's are just, it's impossible to get up for a Fisher star. But I like Vargas because I think he works quickly. He's better than a blah pitcher in that at least his changeup is out. He has something to offer, and he's
more interesting to watch. But I just never when I'm like daydreaming around or thinking about baseball or whatever, I never have an epiphany of like, oh, I should investigate Jason Vargas's blank.
Yeah,
you know, where I never find myself casually surfing around Baseball Reference looking at Jason Vargas's splits, those sort of things. You know, it's just. That's the way it is.
I wonder if it's that we're interested in people who are great or have the potential to become great, and it's clear that neither Vargas nor Fister does. It's the same reason we don't go trolling around for Ryan Langerhans' splits. Or, I mean, so Brendan Ryan we wrote a lot about because he's new, and he has outstanding defense. So if Brendan Ryan can hit, this is a bad example to bring up, because Brendan Ryan has the potential to be great. But Adam Moore, I don't want to write about Adam Moore because I find him uninteresting because his ceiling is so low.
Yeah, that's probably, I mean, that's certainly part of it.
I mean, that's why I'm never going to write about Aaron Laffey again. In fact, you have my word, Lookout Landing. I will never. I take that. He'll blow a game.
Yeah, I guess, well, then you could just have me write about it.
Tricky.
So who are you more excited about being 0-6, Boston or Tampa? Which tickles your fancy more?
Oh, this is... Okay. Okay. Okay, hold on. I have to say Boston by a smidge just because... it's funny because they were supposed to be one of the best teams... Well, Boston thought they were going to be one of the best teams ever, and they very well may be. For now on, Tampa Bay, it's less crazy just because people can explain it like, oh, they lost all this name value. They brought in these old players and they have no budget. Okay, that's not really surprising. Boston is like, hey, if you were the new us last year, that would be delightful. If you lose 100 games, then we'll see who's laughing now as we lose 95
games. Right.
Yeah, so that's my answer. But they both kind of tickle me. And I know a lot of people don't understand why I'm against Tampa Bay now, but you know that I live in Portland, so I think that's basically the answer that you need. Because fuck them, they're too big.
It's funny how we have gone such a 180. We were among the first people to start championing the Rays pretty much right away in 2008. I was doing it kind of in the offseason leading up to the 2008 season, actually. And I know you were right there. I don't know if what you wrote about it or not, but I mean, right away when the Mariners started sucking, by literally May, we were talking about jumping on the Rays bandwagon when they were like 20 games into the season and just, you know, were 11-10 or something like that. It was just like, hey, they're not terrible. This could be the year. And then look what happened. And then basically as soon as they won the pennant, I was just like, all right, I don't care anymore.
Yep. That was it. I didn't even give a shit about the World Series.
Yeah, but it went from we were championing this. God, it's so hipster of us to have done this, but it really was not, at least for me, it was not out of a motivation of, oh, now they're all popular, so I hate them. Although it kind of is, but it's difficult to explain, I guess. Or maybe that is just how they act. Maybe I just, now I get hipsterism. But
yeah,
it was really just, you know, like we were on the forefront of rooting for them. At least this is what happened to me. They won the pennant. I didn't immediately start rooting against them. So it wasn't like, oh, they went mainstream, now I hate them. But it was just, I got indifferent to them. And that was basically the 2009 season. I was just like, whatever. Okay, it's old. Yeah, the Rays are good. Old news. That happened last year. And we had seen that kind of happening in 2007. Mm-hmm. But 2010 rolls around, and they're still kind of good, and they're still generating. I think for me, it was like they were still in year three of their success, generating these kind of meaningless fluff news stories about, how are the Rays doing this one? I'm just like, where have you been the last 3 years? It was obvious how they did well. Mm-hmm. And this is, that's your, and I just got so irritated, and I'm tired of hearing about the Rays. And I don't think, if you're jumping on a bandwagon, no bandwagon should last that long. Bandwagons are self-contained units.
Yeah.
And
if you bandwagon a team for more than a year, you're a fan of that team.
Right.
That's basically what it is.
I think that is what it is. And I'm not a fan of the Rays. I like the way they put together a team, but part of why we bandwagon them is because we had Bill Bavasi at the time, and it was just, we really needed to see what it was like to root for a team that was well put together. Now, while I don't say that the Mariners are up there with the Rays, we at least got a taste. We had a year and a half of a taste of what it's like to kind of live that life. And so now it's just like, all right, let's stop paying attention to the Rays now.
And of course, Jonah Carey wrote that book about them, which is basically like the behind the music now of the Rays, where it's like, okay, well, I mean, they've already had this special, so they're not new at all. And of course, now I think a lot of people are, they're still interested in the Rays just because they're not the Yankees or the Red Sox, but
yes,
people are more interested in the Blue Jays, and certainly there's going to be a huge current of people jumping onto the Royals bandwagon, which, by the way, I'm already over.
Yeah, no, that was like, wow. Yeah, that was my thing for this year, is that I've already, basically 2008 to 2010 Rays, I condensed into like 1 month with the Royals.
Yeah.
I'm already so sick about hearing about their minor league system. I'm not even waiting for the Royals to get good to champion them and then turn against them when they get popular. I'm already sick of the Royals.
I like that they had all these dramatic wins early because it's with their shitty players.
It was great because it was coming against the Angels.
Oh, that too. But what the difference, obviously, that a lot of you should understand also between the Rays and the Royals is that the Royals are stupid. So it's going to be a little different. Well, I shouldn't say they're stupid. They clearly have their strengths and their struggles, but it's going to be different when they start getting their players phased in. So there's actual possibility they could still blow this, which is selfish. For my own weird little irrational reasons, I'm kind of rooting for it. But I don't really – I think Cleveland maybe – God, I don't want to root for Cleveland. I don't know who's my next
– No, I'm gonna never Diego. Rooting for Cleveland.
Never rooting for Cleveland. I'm sticking to San Diego till they actually make the playoffs, maybe. The Pirates don't excite me just because Pittsburgh, you know. Steelers,
yeah.
Sidney Crosby.
Also, the team is not, you know, that's not a team you can bandwagon because, wow.
Yeah, no. God. And, I mean, other than that, you're just bandwagon teams. I don't know. This is a hard year to bandwagon.
It's too early to think about it. We don't have to think about this. We can bandwagon the Mariners. Hell yeah.
But, God, they're not exciting.
They will in 10 days from now.
I can't wait. I can't fucking wait to see what the Root Sports commercials are like in a month. Like, if the team is bad, are they going to acknowledge it? Are the commercials going to change? I would.
They won't have to. You're gonna have to wait a lot longer than a month, Jeff Sullivan, because a month from now, the Mariners are still going to be around 500. We can still make over-the-top commercials when you're 500.
It's like I'm in the planning stages of a post about this. I want to give it a little more time to see what Root Sports ends up doing. But it's like they did absolutely zero market research when they came up with these commercials. I know that they do commercials for like the other teams that they air, like the Oregon State Beavers college baseball team, by the way. But just with the Mariners. Yeah. Remember,
Beaver Fever.
This is Seattle. This is the same city that didn't want their football team to win and go into the playoffs. This is the same city that I saw a poll, I think it was on ESPN, the only state that didn't think their baseball team would contend this year.
Yes. I don't remember what the actual question was, but I do remember there was something about hometown rooting, and Washington was the only state that was not.
You know what
was.
The commercial should be is like, Mariners going to Oakland tomorrow. Hope to see ya. Or Felix is pitching. They could win a game. Michael Pineda on Sunday. Hope to see you for 6 to 7 innings.
Your 2011 Seattle Mariners, now made of 95% recyclable parts. Which is basically what it is, because we're giving away free compost this season.
Seattle Mariners
baseball.
They're
such a stereotype.
I feel like we should have done more with that than we did, which was nothing. We did nothing with it. But, I mean, let's face it, the Mariners are giving away trash.
Is that all the time? Or I thought it was on a specific, like, day.
I thought it was on I don't know.
If it's on a specific day, I assume we'll do something when that day comes around.
Well, now we have time to prepare. But, I mean, for a Northwest flair, it's like, baseball, outdoors, chance to get in the sunshine. The Mariners are the last team that will litter the bleachers with baseballs, you know? It's like, no, they don't consume, you know? They do everything efficiently, you know?
Yes.
God, this is hard to do.
And how so on and so forth. Pemco ads, basically, for the entire team.
Yeah, I wish I would have thought.
They could have just hired the Pemco marketers. Or whoever does their commercials, and just be like, that's what they should have done. The Mariners should do that.
You know, maybe the whole problem is that they went with Root Sports, and they could have just named it Watch Sports. That would have been, that really would, I think, have captured. I don't watch often the Mariners now and be like, I'm rooting for the Mariners. Oh, I'm watching a Mariners game from my sofa. So I think the channel should reflect that and be like, Watch Sports. Tomorrow.
Or maybe there should be a question mark after one of the two words. I'm not sure which of the two yet, but
hey, you know, if it
Roots,
was
Root Sports or Root Sports. I don't know which one's more Northwesty.
Unfortunately, there was an opportunity there. If it was Watch Sports, I could have gone back to my quartz mine. We would have had a whole loop, but that opportunity is blown until I brought it up just now. But yeah, I anticipate that we're going to have a lot of fun with Root Sports just because it's fucking obnoxious.
Obnoxious. I think it's obnoxious in the entertaining way.
It is.
Like,
now,
I won't get tired of it this year.
It's too serious, by the way.
It's too funny.
The channel is a week old, and I would love it if they changed, and I would love it if they didn't change a thing. Mariners roll in at 59 and 97. Taking all the New York Yankees? Yeah, well, you Yankees haven't tasted, I really should have written some jokes.
They call them the Bronx Bombers, but we're going to show them what the city from Boeing brings. Something, you know, whatever.
We
build better bombers than they do.
With our fastballs. Woo! Gene and Dustin Pedroia tomorrow, 7:05. Death Sports. I mean, at some point, that would be so funny if they kept it up, though.
I know. I hope they do. I really, really hope they do.
Anybody from Root Sports listening to this podcast?
Don't change a thing.
You're doing great. Oh, I didn't anticipate this. I mean, the whole, like, I don't know what the fan interaction changes have been. I guess there's some stuff that's like pregame and postgame, but I don't watch those anyway.
Yeah, as long as it stays exactly as it is, don't change anything, including the promos and how you broadcast the game, because I do not want to start seeing a Twitter stream during the game.
Yeah, no. I mean, I think that was always kind of a hyperbolic fear, I thought, but maybe in a year or two that'll actually be true.
Yeah.
Man, I feel like I blew an opportunity to come up with some good Root Sports jokes on this podcast. I'm just not.
That's all right. That's okay. Next podcast.
Next podcast, we'll still be talking about Root Sports.
Of course we will, because it will still not be ironic yet, because the Mariners are going to be at least 500.
Well, we're not going to podcast. Well, you said they would be 500 after that 10-game streak.
I said at least 500.
So you anticipate that not only will they get to 500, at least, but they will get to 500 by the time we next podcast.
Right.
Interesting.
Well, since we don't podcast on a regular schedule, that really could be whenever.
That's true.
Stay tuned for the next Mariners podcast, which will occur the very next time the Mariners eclipse a 500 record. I don't care if it's next year.
Putting our foot down. We're under control here.
And Jeff's not going to write about Aaron Laffey.
God, this is going to be hard. I'm going to try, though. Anyway, we've been talking for a long time, so until the next time we talk for a long time, signing out now. Watch sports.
Get out of that mine.
I can't. I have to work.